Hi, my name is Jimmy, alcoholic. There is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confessions of shortcomings, which the process requires for a successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others. We had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence, which we have not even dreamed. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we had deep and effective spiritual experiences, which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves.
Thank you, Jimmy. And I've asked Spencer to read the steps.
Spencer, I'm an alcoholic. Yes, 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. 1. We admit we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to prove our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for His knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Spencer. And our speaker tonight is Russell. He's here to share his experience, strength, and hope. So let me introduce Russell. Thank you very much.
Great job. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't found necessary to take a drink, nor have I had a drink. You know, you got to add that. You know, heard about those two guys in Texas. The guy says, I haven't found necessary to have a drink in 20 years. And the other guy says, Hank, I saw you drunk last night. And he says, yeah, but it wasn't necessary. So I haven't found it necessary to take a drink, nor have I had a drink since January 25th, 1981, through the grace of God. And now some of you might hear a tape somewhere where I say it was since January 17th, 1981. And that's not a different Russell. I just figured out I was wrong by a week or something. So for like 30 years, I've been lying about my sobriety. So I figured I'd straighten that deal up, you know. So I feel much better now. I just got the date of the Super Bowl mixed up or something like that. So it's good to be here. Somebody remarked that this was a pretty young crowd, you know. Anything south of 50 is young to me. I mean, my shoes are older than most of you guys. You know, it's... So it's good to be here, and I'm gonna spend a little time telling you about my life, my life today. I'm probably not gonna spend a whole lot of time. This may be different than some drunkology here, or, you know, what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. Many years ago, somebody told me that your story will change. You know, when I first came in here and I was asked to tell my story, I spent a lot of time on, and then I drank, and then I drank, and then I drank. That stuff is important for identification. I love a good drunkologue. I listened to many of them, and you're going to hear a lot of good drunkologues. But as you stay sober over a period of time, and, you know, if I don't drink by the time January rolls around, it'll be about 31 years, you've experienced quite a lot of things. And experience is very important. It says our stories disclose in a general way what the story is with us. Stories and testimony are important. My first sponsor told me when he was talking about, you know, because I'm also a recovering smartass. You know? Sure, you're laughing, you don't know what it's like, but yeah, I'm a recovering know-it-all, and And I was terribly under-sponsored. The only thing I ever respected or I ever looked up to was my own brain, because I was so brilliant, you know. And I was going from my doctorate in mathematics, studying algebraic topology, and if you didn't know what the Schrodinger wave equation was or quantum mechanics or, you know, all that sort of good stuff, you know, I didn't really respect you. And and I remember my first sponsor, I was terribly under-sponsored. You know, when you come in, you're vulnerable and you're stupid, you don't know what you're doing and you're scared. So some guy who never even graduated high school got a hold of me, and you know, and I took him into my office. I ultimately went to law school, and I have this wall, you know, my wall of fame with all these diplomas and certificates and all sorts of stuff. You know, I've been educated far beyond my capacity to even understand anything. And I showed him all the degrees I had. I said, Bob, look at all my degrees. And he said, you know, Russ, rectal thermometers have degrees, and you know what they do with those. And that's my real problem. My real problem is I never got any respect from older members of Alcoholics Anonymous. These guys apparently didn't read the part where it said love is intolerance is our code, you know, any of that stuff. They were pretty mean. But you know what they say about children who are abused? They become abusers, so I can somehow get a little abusive. I'll try to be light with you guys. And so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about drinking. I do assure you, you know, I didn't get here because I ate too much ice cream, although it may look that way. But, you know, I got to a point in my life. I'm going to talk a little bit about the alcohol, but I really want to talk about the thing I want to talk about is about sobriety. I want to talk about the next, what Bill Wilson termed the next frontier. I want to paint a little vision for you about something I don't think it's maybe talked a lot about in AA meetings. Bill Wilson talked about emotional sobriety being the next frontier. He said our real problem was something called unhealthy dependencies. And that's the stuff I want to share. I want to talk about that little part in the book. You know, it's nice to identify with the jaywalker and, you know, the guy, the drinking stories and all that sort of stuff, But I'll tell you, I want people to understand they can identify with that part in the book where it says we've experienced much of heaven and we've been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. If you know what, if your life isn't about that, and believe me, I'm one of these guys that believe that if you're an alcoholic, no matter how bad you're doing and how bad things are going, if you haven't had a drink, you're a success. But I'll tell you something, what you really want to shoot for in this deal is you want to shoot for that situation. Experiencing much of heaven and being rocked into the fourth dimension of existence. You want to shoot for the promises permanently. You want to know what that's all about, and that's what I want to sort of talk about. I flushed my life down the toilet when I was 31 years old. 31 years old, I couldn't envision a life without drinking. I thought my life was over and it was never going to get better again. I spiritually and almost physically died. I didn't lose everything, but I lost probably the most important thing to me, and that was my self-respect and my self-esteem. And I got to that place where they refer to it in the book as the jumping off place. And a few things happened to me before. You know, I hurt a lot of people. And I'll talk a little bit about that. And, you know, you don't do this thing alone. You don't get to the place where I got to without ripping people's hearts out and hurting them. And I hurt a lot of people. But finally, I got to the point where I got on my knees and I asked for God's help. And I wasn't even a religious guy, and I wasn't a spiritual guy, and I just believed, the only thing I ever believed in was me, American Express cards, and women, you know, and I was going to find her, you know, she was going to fix me, and I was always on the lookout for her, the one who was going to fix me. That's what I was really addicted to, you know. Yeah, I wanted a new car, because if you have a new car, you have a better shot of getting her. And I wanted money, because if you have money, you got a better shot of getting her. You know, and I wanted a new suit, and I wanted to lose 50 pounds, and I wanted to be good looking, and I wanted to have a certificate, you know, next to my name, JD, or Dr. Spout, or something like that, because then you have a better shot of getting her. And I'll tell you, I've sponsored many, many men in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they say 0.5% stay sober for more than 30 years, and I can't tell you how many of them. And I'm not a gal, so I'm only going to talk about the guys in a sense. I have a feeling that it's the same thing for the gals, though. I can't tell you how many guys have gotten drunk because even though they've stopped drinking, they're still addicted to her. They still got that old idea that some woman's going to fix them, or some suit of clothes or a man of money or something like that is going to fix them. But I suffer from that disease called alcoholism, where drinking is but a symptom of the disease. As a matter of fact, I never really experienced alcoholism, truly, I think, until I got sober. I was sober for a while. I experienced something called drunk. It's a different thing. You see, because when alcoholism would raise its ugly head, and I didn't even know what it looked like, it felt like, all I know is that when alcoholism, it could be a mile away, I could see it a mile away, and I would say something like this, because I was an alcoholism like thermometer. I was a measuring stick for alcoholism, because when alcoholism raised its ugly head, and it was a mile away, and it hadn't even hit me yet, I would say something like, I need a drink. That's what alcoholics do. They say, pull the damn car over, I need a drink. I need five drinks, you know? I didn't even know what alcoholism was, because I got the medicine, the only medicine. That's why I drank. Because no woman, no car, no amount of money, no suit of clothes, no nothing worked for me just as well as just a few drinks. And if alcohol did for you what it did for me, you drink it too. And if alcohol still did for me what it did for me when it first started drinking, I'd probably still be drinking. But unfortunately, or fortunately, whatever, it doesn't work for me anymore. And so I stopped drinking it. You know, but the problem is after I stopped drinking it, and this happens to a lot of people in alcohol. You want to experience alcoholism. You want to experience what alcoholism is all about. Stop drinking alcohol. You know, it says men and women drink because we like the effect produced by alcohol. We are restless, irritable, and discontented unless we can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. And they're talking about how we are sober. Restless, irritable, and discontented unless we can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks we see others taking with impunity. And you know, I'll tell you what alcoholism is. When you're 18 months sober and it's 3 o'clock in the morning and there's nobody to talk to and you got a million voices in your head and it's all bad shit about yourself and other people and you're scared something bad's going to happen. You don't know what it is, but it's going to be bad. You know, and it's racing around in your head and it's all about money and it's all about people and it's all about things that happened in the past and things that happened yesterday and things that seem little, but you know they're going to end up being big, and it's going to mean this is going to happen, or that's going to happen, and there's all this unknown crap that's going on out there, and you got to control everything and everybody, and people's thoughts, and people's minds, and how they feel about you, and it's like the two psychiatrists that pass themselves in the hall, each other in the hall. One says hi, and the other one thinks, I wonder what he meant by that. You know, my sponsor, I used to say to my sponsor, I'm sensitive. He says, no, you're not. He says, great artists are sensitive. You're just touchy. And I was touchy. I was touchy and I was hyper and it was 18 months sober and I was going crazy, going out of my skin with fear and resentment and loneliness and despair. You know, like most people, like the novel says, live lives of quiet desperation. And I knew it couldn't have been alcohol. Because I had stopped drinking 18 months ago, and it wasn't alcohol, it was something called alcoholism. And unfortunately, if you're an alcoholic like me and you have the same disease I have, the disease goes on even after you stop drinking. It goes on forever. You know, but I got a reprieve from that deal now, and that's what I want to talk about. And even more than a reprieve, I want to talk about the real deal. What's really in store for you if you take this little trip. And you decide to really throw it all in and do it right. So I guess I stopped drinking when the consequences of my drinking came at me faster than my ability to lower my standards. You know, alcoholics do that. You can rip out people's hearts. You can hurt people. You become a fungus on society. You become the worst slime you can possibly imagine and somehow feel that you're doing really good. You could lower your standards so low that no matter how bad it gets, somehow you just know you're doing okay. But when it came at me too fast and I could no longer deny it, I looked myself in the mirror, who am I kidding? And then I finally reached out and I spoke to a guy who ended up being my first sponsor, Bob Sullivan. That was the guy who told me about the rectal thermometers and all that sort of stuff. And he said a whole lot of things that I'm going to tell you about because you know, what I found is men that are sober here that I respect are always talking about other men. They're always talking about the people that they followed through these rooms. And he also said to me one time, because I told him, I was trying to figure out how I could get balance in my life. You know, I didn't want to say anything to take over. You know, I lived a life where I went to the bar at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and I went out at 4 o'clock in the morning. and I had a wife and a child and a house on my hand, and I would spend 12 hours in a bar, and that was just one day, and that was easy to do. And so I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm trying to figure out how I could shave it down to 3 meetings a week. And so, because I want to have balance in my life. And I said to him, my sponsor, I said, I don't think I have to go to meetings on Thursday. And he looked at me and said, sure, as long as you never drank on Thursdays. I drank all the time. You know, and that's when he said to me, he says, Russ, you know as much about life as a dog knows about his father. Yeah, I had to think about it too. I had gone through college. I had become a National Science Foundation fellow. I graduated with the Department of Honors in Mathematics, graduated law school, had all these degrees and certificates, had all sorts of experience in academia. You know, I thought I was a pretty smart guy. I was a smart guy. Division chief of the state's attorney's office, prosecuting multi-murder cases and in charge of attorneys. And I had never had anybody in my entire life talk to me that way. It wasn't even that he was talking down to me or making fun of me. That wasn't even the point. It was that way. Who says things like that? You know as much about, where do they get this stuff? Is there some sort of like cliche AA sponsor thing going on in Georgia or something? You know as much about life as a dog knows about his father? You got to go to the Encyclopedia Britannica to figure that one out. So the only thing I could do is I sat there dumbfounded, because when I came to AA, I had two neurons working and they were waving goodbye at each other. You know what I mean? I'd start a sentence with you, and mid-sentence I'd forget what I was talking about. And so the only thing I could do is, some of you guys are too young to remember this, and you got to excuse me, but some of you guys do. RCA Victor, you know RCA? Used to have this logo. They probably still do, I don't even know. Where they'd have a dog with like a cute little dog with a patch's eye looking into a phonograph. You know what I mean? Have you guys ever seen that? Well, yeah. And what I do is, when he said that to me, I pictured that dog like a doggy daddy and then a doggy mommy. And then I picture all sorts of like doggy babies, like puppies around, like a doggy family. Because I was trying to figure, you know as much about life. And then it dawned on me about 5 minutes into it that you know as much about life as a dog knows about his father. And then I realized that a dog doesn't know his father. Because I thought he was complimenting me. You know, So he looked me in the eye and he said to me, I was all set to tell him when he came at me that he had the wrong guy, that he didn't understand. You know, if you came at me, because if you wanted to talk to me about my drinking, you know, I'll tell you what, you know, I was all set for you. You know, I'd say, I know you think I have a drinking problem. You know, from where you stand. I'd kill them with a piece they didn't know, you know, because I was so unique. You know, I said, but if you only knew the problems, I don't have a drinking problem. You see, I drink because I have problems. I have serious, unique problems. If you only knew how, you know, all about my divorce, and if you all only knew about my ex-wife, and you only knew about the family I grew up in, and if you only knew every time I tried to start out and doing it all right and it fell to crap in my hands, you'd understand that I don't have a drinking problem. I drink because I have problems. And as a matter of fact, my drinking perfectly matches my problems. And pretty soon, my problems are going to go away, you know, and I won't have to drink anymore. So thank you very much for your advice, but why don't you go screw yourself? So, you know, I mean, it was like, I didn't have a lot of people having hard-to-hard talks with me, because if you want to talk to me about my drinking, you better be prepared for me to talk about the worst thing I know about you and your mother, you know, because you were going to come at me, but it wasn't going to be for free. But he threw me a curve. He didn't talk to me about my drinking, he told me about his drinking, and I started to identify. He knew how to make a 12-step call. He told me about himself. And after he was done talking, I started to identify. And after he told me about himself, he says, you know, Russ, he says, you know, you don't have to drink again if you don't want to. And I didn't want to drink anymore. You know, everybody's got, I don't rob alcoholics of their last drink. Never want to rob an alcoholic of his desperation. You know, I don't try to, you know, people want to drink, you know, hey, God bless them. You know, alcohol will be a better convincer than I will. You know, he says, you don't have to drink anymore if you don't want to, and you never have to feel this way again if you don't want to. And I walked into an AA room back in January of 1981, and I picked up a white chip. And that was probably, quite frankly, and somehow, I don't know how this will sound, but I mean, this is just the bottom line. When I got up in front of that group of people, 30 or 40 people, who I didn't know, and I walked up in front of them, and I picked up that chip. I made that long walk from the back of the room to pick up that chip. which is basically declaring to everybody that you need help and you're brand new. When this egomaniac did that, I was probably mentally and emotionally at my best in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's all been downhill from there, I can tell you that. I've been fighting to get back to that deal, but what AA has done, it's done a lot for me, and I want to talk a little bit about that. Apparently, unfortunately, I've gotten progressively dumber. I used to be brilliant. I really was, and I've gotten really stupid. AA will do that to you. You know, I don't really know much. I don't really think a lot about things, and you'd be amazed how well you can do in life if you don't use your brain. I mean, you'd be absolutely amazed. I know you think you need. You see, when you're totally self-centered and you're selfish and you're driven by 100 forms of fear, and you know you got to control everything and everybody, because when you're scared crapless all through your body that if you don't have or you don't get or you lose or something's going to happen to you, and you're scared of everybody and everything, you got to be awake and you got to be aware and you got to be on top of things and you got to know what people are thinking and why they're thinking, and you got to worry about stuff and be concerned about stuff, because if you don't, something's going to happen. I don't know what it is, but it's going to be bad. And so you got to be constantly thinking about a million things, like some sort of weird computer. But you want to know something? A strange thing happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. Apparently, like it says in the big book, see that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. When you start realizing that you have no power and you can't manage your own life, and no human power is going to manage it for you or straighten you out, but God could and would if he was sought. When you start realizing and developing something called faith, whatever that is, in God, you know, all of a sudden what happens is you stop worrying about controlling people, because you see, when you're not scared, you don't have to control. You know, I don't have to control whether you like me. I don't have to worry about what I'm going to say. I don't have to run it through the filter. Will this sound good? Will they like me? Do they not like me? I can just be myself. I can just be transparent. And I'm so much better at being myself than anybody else. You know, I used to try to be what you wanted me to be. Try to figure out what I had to say to make you like me. And then worry about whether you like me afterwards, as if you're paying my Visa bill. You know, and what happens is when you start running scared, now I know alcoholics say things like, what do we say? We say things, well, I don't give a crap what he thinks about me. I don't give a crap what he thinks about, I could care less what he thinks about me. But you know, one of the things you learn, you know, after 31 years of doing this stuff and being 62 years old, is that people that don't care what other people think about them don't say shit like, I don't give a crap what they think about me. They just don't say stuff like that. They say stuff like, pass the pizza. You know, I don't know what they say, but they don't say that stuff. You know what I mean? And all I did was live my entire life worrying about what you thought about me. And here's the crazy thing. I actually thought you were thinking about me. But when that's the deal, when your whole life is like that, and you're selfish and you're self-centered, and you don't even know that's the problem, because that's just the way you think, and your alcoholic life seems the only normal one, and the way you think seems the only natural way to think, and you don't even realize, as bright as you are, and if you're really bright, you can really screw yourself up, because you can make some really bad choices and really bad judgments because emotion is somehow tied into it, but you think you're right because you're intelligent enough to fool yourself. And so you rationalize. You tell yourself rational lies, and you do some sort of messed up thing, and you're constantly busting relationships and choosing the wrong guy or choosing the wrong gal or doing the wrong thing or saying the wrong thing. And then finally coming in, they say it's selfishness, self-centeredness, and you don't even know what that is because you don't even see where you're selfish because you think you're a great guy. And then you're trying to fix that selfishness thing, and they say, yeah, but only God can do it. And you don't even believe in him or know what that's all about. And it says we got to get rid of our selfishness. We have to, or it kills us. And I just got rid of the alcohol, and I have no idea what they're talking about. And I'm sitting here struggling with this deal, this thing called alcoholism. And so I was married to my first. I've been married. A little bit about me. I've got 4 kids in sobriety and 6 grandkids. And somehow I'm the worst father in the world. And I'm a great grandfather. You know, you see what happened was, I don't know how this worked out, but somehow, some way, well, my sponsor said, don't make any major decisions during your first year, and after 3 months, I got married. I didn't think it was a big deal. It actually saved my ass, because the bottom line is it probably kept me out of the singles deal, you know, but I mean, So I got married, and that's a trip, learning how to live with she who must be obeyed. And she's a member of Al-Anon. Our Ladies of Perpetual Revenge. My son-in-law, who's got like 7 years, is having a party now for his 30th birthday, and she's with him, and we got A running all through the family and stuff like that, and sobriety, and there's all sorts of stuff, which I probably won't have time to talk to you about. But the bottom line is, so I got married, and but I had a first wife. She's a wonderful girl. She was a beautiful girl, and I met her in college. Just a great gal from a great family, gave me a wonderful son. We had a beautiful house on Miami Beach on the golf course, Lagorse Golf Course, and I was a young guy, 26 years old, you know, division chief in the state's attorney's office, and about 100 pounds lighter, and pretty heady stuff, getting my name in the paper and all that sort of deal, and trying all sorts of big deals and cases and everything. One Friday morning, she looked at me and she said, "I just want you to know, if you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you." And, you know, she didn't say it like to start a fight. It wasn't one of these, she wasn't that kind of person. She wasn't a nagger or anything like that. She didn't say it to start a fight. It was almost like she was like delivering the mail. It's like, "I thought you ought to know. If you come home drunk, I just thought you ought to know. If you come home drunk one more time, I'm out of here." You know, because apparently she had something called self-esteem, whatever that is, you know. And, well, some women, you know, will say it, but they won't mean it. Or they'll never say it. They'll just feel sorry for themselves. We call them Al-Anoners and, you know. They go to Al-Anon or something. I don't know what they do. But she, you know, she was, "Hey, listen, one more time, I'm out of here." And, you know, I've analyzed that statement. If you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. You know, you can't even take a word out of that sentence. What word would you take? If? Leaving? If you come home one more time drunk, I'm leaving you. Everything that's important to you or should be important to you in your life is gone. Your house, your child, your wife, everything. If you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. You figure a guy with all sorts of degrees, you know, all sorts of knowledge. And I was when she said that sentence to me on a Friday morning, I was as physically sober then as I am now. And probably a lot smarter because, you know, remember I said I've gotten progressively dumber in AA. I mean, I know that's actually true. I mean, I must be stupid because all my sponsees tell me I don't understand. So I can't be too bright. Actually, I'm only good for two things now. I've realized I'm only good for two things these days, and that is helping people that are in pain and hugging my grandkids. I'm actually better than at hugging my grandkids. But in any event, so that's what she said. She said, "If you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you." I figure that's a pretty simple statement, right? And so I got in my car, thought about that. If you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. I got to the first light, 5 minutes down the road, and I said to myself this: what the hell did she mean by that? Now, let me tell you something. Let me tell you, I'm just talking about my experience. You know, I'm not talking about theories here. You know, my sponsor once said, experience is very important. You know, if you're an alcoholic and you're drinking at bars, you got all sorts of theories and all sorts of bullshit and all sorts of "I think," and "this is my opinion." But after 31 years and 62 years on the planet and watching people in and out, I'll tell you, experience is more trumps knowledge. You know, when a man with experience meets a man with money, the man with experience will walk away with the money, and the man with the money will walk away with an experience. So the bottom line is, I sat there and I said, what the hell did she mean by that? Now, trust me on this. If when somebody says to you something like, "You come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you," and it confuses you, that's sort of like the judge says, "Then if you do it one more time, you're going to jail." And you walk out and say, "What the hell was that all about?" You know what I mean? You know those people like Britney Spears? They always wind up in front of the judge again. I'm telling you, when you can know the Schrodinger wave equation, you can know quantum mechanics, you can be the brightest bulb on the planet. If you can't figure out, if you come home drunk more time, I'm leaving you, trust me, you're in for a sorrowful, hurtful life somewhere down the road. And what I learned by that about my alcoholism and about alcoholics in general when I sponsor people is that whenever an alcoholic hears or is told something or reads something he doesn't like, it confuses him. Now listen, this I'm telling you, I'm giving you a gem here. You're going to trust me on this. Whenever an alcoholic hears something, is told something, or reads something he doesn't like, it confuses him. And if it confuses him or gets him angry, he throws it away. So trust me on this. I know this from personal experience. A lot of people read the big book. Some people don't even read it, but a lot of people read it, and they think they've read the big book, but they haven't. Because what they've done is they've come to sentences like, see to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. If you sincerely take this position, all sorts of remarkable things happen. That, you know, God couldn't win if he were so, whatever it is, they come to sentences that they don't like. They don't like them. And it confuses them. So you just throw them away. And after reading the entire book, and being 3 or 4 or 5 years sober, they've thrown away about 90% of the book, or haven't even read it or understood it. And what they really think Alcoholics is, what they really think this program is all about, is acceptance is the answer to all of my problems. And that's their sum total knowledge of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people that are doing the program. And if they manage to stay somehow sober for 10 or 15 years, around 15 or 20 years, they start seeing there's other stuff in the big book, and the stuff they threw out was the most important stuff. Because it's the stuff they threw out because they didn't want to go there, because it required even more sacrifice and getting rid of even more ideas, and they didn't really want to grow up. So in any event, I'm 3 months sober. Don't they have this thing in the big book? Don't they read it after every meeting? If you want what we have, and are ready to go to any length to get it, then and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Is that in the big book somewhere? Do they read that tonight? Do they read that before meetings? If you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Did you know that in order to take the steps, you got to be ready? Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't take the steps, even if you're not ready. You shouldn't try to take the steps and, you know, this thing has gotten better. But if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready. You ever think about what that statement means? You ever think about that? Well, you know, it seems to imply that there is a prerequisite. You know, I went to college. We'd have things called prerequisites. In order to take, you know, trigonometry, you'd have to take algebra first. Or in order to take multivariable calculus, you'd have to take something before something else. Well, apparently it says if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. You know, there are some people that come in here, I hate to clue you on this, they don't want what we have. They don't even know what we have. They don't even see what they have. You know what they want? They want their old life back. They want the money back. They want the job back. They want the gal back. They want the car back. They just want it all back. The same crap that they were worried about, the same stuff that they know will make them okay, you know, just a little more Viagra, because the whole world and total happiness depends upon whether or not you can have an erection for 4 hours. You know, I know you're chuckling and I say that. Y'all ought to watch TV and see how much billions of dollars this country's being, and you all are being dumbed down by giving you the explanation that your spiritual life and who you are and what kind of person you are depends upon whether or not you have an erection or how much sex you have. Over and over and over again every day watching that stuff, and if you think it doesn't have an effect on your psyche and how you feel about yourself and whether you think you're successful or not, you don't know anything about the disease of alcoholism. You don't know anything about how much you look at other people and look at movie stars and look at commercials and how much you measure yourself by that. You don't really understand what's going on here. You don't get it. And it's going to be a sorry deal, because you're going to start thinking to yourself there's something wrong with you because of things that have nothing to do with anything, because somebody's trying to make a buck. But I digress. So some people don't want what we have. And some people want what we have. They sort of want what we have. They think they see what we have. But, you know, they're not willing to go to any length. They're just not willing to. It's not like they're not willing to climb Mount Rushmore. They're not willing to turn off their cell phones. Then they're not willing not to talk during a meeting. They're not willing to do anything because they're just so important. There's so other things that are important in their mind. They're just not, they don't want what we have. And I'll tell you what, if that's true, if what they say in the big book is true, you know, if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then I guess in order to do this thing, you got to have a we. If you want what we have, I guess there's got to be a we. You know, Bill Dotson, the man on the bed, you ever see that man on the bed thing? He wrote a book. It says, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous number 3. After 6 weeks sober, after he got out of the hospital, he was transfixed by Bill Wilson. When he was 15 years sober, he was asked to write something for the big book. It's in there, Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, the man on the bed. And in the last part of that book, he says, I knew, and I don't have the book, I wish I had, I read it to you, he says, I knew there was something more, something I hadn't got. You ever go to meetings and you see people say, you know there's something more, something you hadn't got, I mean, you're not drinking, but you know there's more, and he said, and he was looking at Bill Wilson, while Bill Wilson was eating a tuna fish sandwich with his wife Henrietta in his kitchen. And he was watching him. He was watching this man. He was staring at him because Bill Wilson was part of his we. And Bill Wilson said this line. You know, this line. He spoke about this. Bill Dotson spoke about this after 15 years. Wrote in the big book. It's there. You ought to read it. He calls it the golden text of AA. And Bill Wilson turned to Henrietta. He wasn't even talking to him. Bill Wilson was talking to Henrietta. He wasn't even talking to Bill Dotson. He overheard it. And Bill Wilson said this to Henrietta. He said, you know, Henrietta, he says, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I got to keep talking about it and telling other people. And he says that line. He says, Bill Wilson was grateful for being sober, and he gave all his gratitude and all credit to God. And he says, that line has kept me sober and has been the golden text for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because Bill Wilson was part of his we, and he was looking at Bill Wilson. He wanted what he had because he knew Bill Wilson had something more than mere physical sobriety. And there are some people in here, a few, that have a we. They've developed a we. And you know, I'm 62 years old, and I've got a sponsor who's got 57 years sobriety, and I follow him around. And you know, the funny thing about guys that have a lot of sobriety, I'm talking about not only a lot, but quality sobriety. You know, who are on that rocket ship ride. You know, they tend to hang out with other guys like that. You know, I was told the man you'll be in 5 years will depend upon the people you hang out with and the books you read. And trust me, the books you read depends upon the people you hang out with. What you talk about, what the conversations are about, the quality of the conversations depends upon the people you're hanging out with and who you're discussing things with. You know, and when I was 3 months sober, my then sponsor, Bob Sullivan, I've had three because, you know, people come to me and says, will you be my temporary sponsor? I said, I don't know how to make it permanent. Because I buried two of them. Wonderful, wonderful men that I'll always give credit to. And my sponsor, Bob Sullivan, when I was 3 months sober, took me to he was part of my we. Joe Snyder was part of my we. Ray O'Keefe was part of my we. All these guys they introduced me to, they had something going on. You know, I don't know how many of you guys are involved in sports. Now, I've never been involved in sports. You know, I'm like the worst guy in sports, but I know one thing. I know that whatever you're involved in, whether it's karate, whether it's cross training, whether it's mixed martial arts, whatever the deal is, and I watch the Olympics like we all do, there are people that play golf. There are a lot of people that play golf. I mean, I've even played golf, you know, if that's what you can call it. You know, and then there's Tiger Woods. And then there's Tiger. You know, there's people that box, and then there's Muhammad Ali. You know, there's people that are involved in every sport, in every endeavor in life, and then there are Olympic champions. You know, the best of the best of the best, and then five levels higher. And you know they're playing the exact same game that you're playing, but they ain't playing the same game. Because their whole life, their whole being, everything is focused on that deal. They eat, drink, and sleep that deal. And you can see it in their lives. You can see it in the way they think. And you know that even though Tiger's playing golf and you're playing golf, you ain't playing, whatever game he's playing, that's not the game you're playing. You know, and you know, whether you're a lawyer, you're a doctor, whatever you do in your life, you know there are people that are held in high esteem. I was talking to a guy I sponsor. He does something called cross training. Cross, whatever it is. And where I was talking to him about this, and these kind of people, and I said to him, I said, he says, yeah, he says, do you have people like that? He says, in this cross training thing, which is apparently has to do with running triathlons and doing all, I don't even know what it has to do with. He says, yeah, he says, what do you call them? He says, we call them fire eaters. I used to be involved in a deal. I'm not involved anymore. When we had people like that, we'd call them road warriors. We had a special name for them. They were like at another spot. You know what I mean? Another place. You know, we got people like that in here. We got people like that in here. And one day when I was 3 months sober, they took me to a meeting called the keynote meeting. My sponsor did. And there was a guy there doing the meeting, I guess sort of like the way I'm doing. I mean, he was doing a better job. He was there at the podium. His name was Al Kennedy. I was 3 months sober, 90 days. I sat in the front, just like you guys are sitting in the front right there, and I was sort of staring at him. I was watching him, you know, and he was talking. He was just talking. He was just sharing, you know. And it was just incredible. You know, I was brought up on John Wayne. I don't know how many of you guys would draw. Some of you older guys probably remember John Wayne. I was brought up in John Wayne. I always wanted to be like John Wayne. You know, I mean, I don't even think John Wayne could be like John Wayne. But I mean, I wanted to be. That's who I looked up to as a man. You know, I always wanted to be. If I want to be, what do you want? I want to be a man. And I was like faking it for a long period of time because I wasn't even sure what a man was. I thought it had something to do with getting laid or something to do with winning fights. You know, and I was no good at either one of those, you know, and but I didn't want anybody to find out about that crap, you know, you're just trying to figure out what it means to be a man, and you're scared that someday somebody, something will happen, they'll figure out you're not one, you know what I mean? And so you hung around with other guys, and you say manly things with manly men, and talk manly shit, and, you know, what about, you know, baseball and stuff like that, and you have no idea what the hell's going on, you're just trying to negotiate your way through life and not look scared, you know, I didn't know what it was, but I know I wanted to be one. Somebody, you know, you see, what I wanted to do is I wanted to rule the world, be self-sufficient, be in charge, and have people looking up to me. And deep down inside, I know I didn't have what it took. And that's a scary deal, because the world scared me. The world is tough. Let me tell you something. It's a humbling experience. So they take me to this meeting. This guy's talking named Al Kennedy. And he's talking about stuff, and he's talking about sobriety, and he's loving on people. And I don't know how to explain it. You know, I'm watching him. He's like one of these guys. You ever with somebody, maybe it's your sponsor, somebody, you just feel good because you're with them. That was like my sponsors. Like, my life would be going down the tubes. But if I could spend 5 minutes with my sponsor, because they were so steady. They were so steady. They were so, you know, it was like they were strong, but they weren't arrogant. They were comfortable in their own skin. It seemed to me like they had an answer for everything. For everything. No matter what my problem was, they would manage to answer the question without answering the question. I don't even understand how that is. One day I told my sponsor my life was falling apart and I needed money and I didn't know what I was going to do. And he said, and he looked at me and he said, you know, you ought to start making coffee for the group. And I said, well, my guy, he says, no, have you made coffee for the group yet? And I said, well, no, but my life's falling apart. He says, I know your life, but I mean, we need someone to make coffee, and I want you to start making coffee. He says, okay. And he starts showing me how to make coffee, and I'm saying, this guy doesn't understand anything. My life is falling apart, and he has me making coffee. And so I make coffee on Monday, and I make coffee on Wednesday, and I make coffee on Thursday, and pretty soon I'm thinking about getting the group early and making the coffee and how much coffee, you know, and some guy would come up to the thing to start making. He says, hey, that's my job, you know what I mean? And made coffee for 18 months. I couldn't get rid of that job. And everything worked out. I don't know what it is. They just know what to say. And I don't know. They go to the sponsor school. So I'm watching this Al Kennedy guy. I'm watching this guy. And he's like one of these guys that, you know, if I could only hang with this guy, I'll be okay. Like, I'll be protected if I can hang with this guy. He was somebody like I wish I could get to know. I wish I could be friends with this guy. You know, I could. You know, I mean, I was. He was sort of scary to me because I knew if I opened up my mouth, he'd know right away. I wasn't. Whatever game he. I was doing the pro. I was an alcoholic.
and he was an alcoholic. And I was working this program at 3 months, and he was working this program. And we were both in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know what I mean? I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was in Alcoholics Anonymous. But you want to know something like Tiger Woods? We were playing a different game. He was doing the Tiger Woods AA, and I was still, we were in different fellowships. I was in the initial fellowship of AA that lasts about 20 years, you know, thumb-sucking crybabies. Go to a few more discussion meetings, you'll know what I'm talking about, you know. Let's have a meeting on relationships. Oh, this gal, you wouldn't believe this. Yeah. Let's go to a few more. I was in the thumb-sucking crybabies, and he was in the fellowship of the Spirit, which is a takeoff of Corinthians, the fellowship of the Holy Spirit. He was in a different deal. And he was loving on people. He was strong, but he wasn't arrogant. And you know something, he was gentle, but he wasn't weak. And he was loving on people, and he was talking to people, and he was explaining people, and he was lifting people up. I thought everybody saw what I saw. I mean, I'm looking at this guy. I said, is everybody seeing what I'm seeing with this guy? Is everybody seeing this guy? This guy right here? Because, you know, I now have a what I think is a strong relationship with God. You know, he's with me all the time. I'm never alone. You know, I have a strong, but you know, back then it wasn't much, you know, but I'm looking at this guy and I'm saying to my, I said, you know, I wish I could have what he had, and I didn't even know what he had, but I knew it was something different. I knew he was at a different level, just like that guy was looking at Bill Wilson. And listen to me, then he walks out the door and, you know, I thought everybody was seeing it. Everybody was watching it. You know, there were two guys in the back talking about the blonde in the front row, and there was another guy smoking a joke. I mean, I don't know what they were looking at, but I was looking at it. I was focused on it because I would run into these guys, and I was, thank God, attracted to that. I was attracted to that. That's what I wanted more than anything else. Now, I still saw the girls. I remember one time I said to my sponsor, I said, look at that blonde in the front row. He looked at me, he says, you know, Russ, he said, what did you used to like to drink? I said, I like scotch. He said, what kind of scotch? I said, J&B. He says, you see that blonde in the front row? I said, yeah. He says, for you, that's a bottle of J&B with legs. Now you laugh. You laugh. But let me tell you how impressionable I was. The next meeting, I'd see that blonde, and she'd look pretty good for about 30 seconds, and then all of a sudden, this big bottle would appear. You know, it sort of took a little bit of spin off my fastball because, you know something, I listened to my sponsor because I wanted what he had. And so I'm looking at Al Kennedy. He walks out the door. I want you to put yourself in my place. I'm transfixed by this guy. I'm looking at this guy. I know we don't put people on pedestals, but we do. Bill, you know, Dr. Bob did. Bill Wilson did. People, that you read Dr. Bob in the Good Old Timers. It's a love story about people that love this guy and they follow these guys and they trusted these guys and they follow that guy. And you know some, there are people in this program that will have AA daddies and AA brothers and AA people that they trust and they follow. And there are people in this program that won't have that at all and will think that's foolish. And they'll be in conversations with themselves. And they'll be running their own lives. And they'll get whatever that deal is. Trust me, there is a consequence to falling in love with the things of this world. There is a consequence to that, to worrying about this stuff and focusing on this stuff as opposed to focusing on the stuff that the big book's talking about. And he walks out the door. Now, I want you to imagine yourself in my position. I'm just looking at this guy, and I'm like amazed. I turned to my sponsor, and I said, man, he was great. You know, I want to see him again. I want to hang out where he hangs out. And my sponsor says this to me. You ready? You know, he's dying. I said, no, I'm talking about the guy who just spoke. He says, he's dying. I said, the guy, that Al Kennedy guy, he says, he's dying of cancer, Russ. He has maybe 2 months to live. He did that whole meeting. He didn't say anything about dying. Listen, if somebody looked at me funny, that was good for 17 meetings. You know what I mean? I mean, I was so filled with self-pity and worrying about myself and my own little plans, my own little designs, my own little life. I couldn't get enough of thinking to myself and worrying about myself, the real disease of alcoholism. Me, 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 me. And here's the guy who's dying, doesn't even mention it. He says, Russ, he's dying, he's got cancer, he's got 2 months to live. 2 months later, he was dead. I couldn't even wrap. Can you imagine? I'm sitting here, every second out of my mouth is, and I had good sobriety in a sense for three, but every word out of my mouth is, What am I going to do about this? What am I going to do about that? Worry, like a drama king, drama queen, whatever it is. And this guy's dying. He's not even mentioning he's trying to help other people. I mean, I would have at least, you know, said, well, it's good to be here. You know, I'm dying, you know. Just thought I'd mention that. You know, I drove up from Miami and I got a week to live. It's no big deal. Don't worry about me. I'm okay. It's like I was going to give my speech on humility tonight, but there's not enough people. I never give it to, a group this small. So, you know what? That guy became part of my we. That guy became part of my we. That guy raised my idea of what AA was all about from the not drinking club. You know, in AA, there's two doors. There's a door that's marked not drinking, and there's another door that says rocking the fourth dimension of existence of which you had not even dreamed. And the entire world is lined up next to the not drinking door, and there's like two or three guys and a gal next to the rocking in the fourth dimension door. They're the Tiger Woods. And every once in a while, you see somebody go from this side of the room, the not drinking club, and walks over to the other side of the room, where the grown-ups hang out. You very rarely see anybody come from the grown-up side going back to the other side. You don't see that much. But you know what that did to me? To see something like that? And you know what's the crazy thing? The crazy thing of that is, you know, maybe you can put it on worship or faith or something like that to look, you know, listen. I may have a relationship with God, and I got to tell you something, but you know what I need? I need to see God manifested and reflected in people's lives. I need to see the magic work in people's lives. I need to see the magician. I need to see the magic trick. I need to see the David Copperfields when the elephants disappear, and you know it's a trick, but you want to know, how did he do that? How does he do that? Because I couldn't do that. I can stop drinking, but how do you not worry about dying? And now I'm 31 years sober. 31 years sober in January. I've been through cancer, radiation therapy, people dying in my life, all sorts of stuff. You know, and the only thing it's done for me is made my faith stronger. You know, our fellowship came from the book of James. The book of James says, chapter 1, he says, rejoice. Rejoice when you have trials and tribulations, because perseverance through those, as you look at God, will make your faith stronger and make you mature. You know, it says that all through the big book. You know what it says in chapter 7? It says we learn where suffering is of great value. We learn the value of suffering. Usually we run away, we lie, we hide, we drink, we will do anything to avoid pain. In AA we say, bring it on. Bring it on. Because I know as I'm going through the crap and they're ripping everything off my skin, I just keep on looking at him, and somehow a month or a year or 2 years later I come out of the thing and I'm almost a grown-up. And all of a sudden they're saying, how come that guy is always the same and he's not whining and crying? You know, and I wanted what that guy had. I wanted that deal. That's what I wanted. And that's available to everybody in this room. And you know, the funny thing is the guys that, you know, and I happen to believe, look, I sponsor a lot of guys that are 15, 20, 25 years sober, and they're miserable. I mean, they're wonderful guys, and they're miserable. That's why they come to me, because I sponsor, because I believe, I know there are people with long-term sobriety that are just doing this by the numbers. And I believe an alcoholic can come in here and do this thing by the numbers, do the four step and do it all by the numbers and still not get that deal. Still not even get the main deal, what this thing is all about, and be miserable with that. And you won't know who they are, because they know how to talk at AA meetings. You know, you won't know the deal. But you know, there's something more available in Alcoholics Anonymous by just not drinking and biting your nails and hanging in there. Man, 15, 20 years sobriety, how you doing? Hanging in there. One day at a time. Why? I put a bullet in my head on that one. 14 years of a dollar in the plate, so I can hang in there. When they're talking about losing the new freedom and the new happiness and losing fear of people and of economic insecurity, you know, seeing where God is doing for you what you can't do for yourself, and you're hanging in there. Whoa. There may be two programs. There may be two fellowships in here. There may be two deals going on in this deal. You know, but you know something's available to everybody. It really is. That's the crazy thing. The crazy thing, and I'll end in this, is the crazy thing about this deal is I didn't realize it that night. I realize it now more than ever after, you know, working with a lot of alcoholics. even though I saw that deal with Al Kennedy, and it transfixed me enough so that I'm sharing it with you now, and I shared almost at every meeting I went to, and there's a lot more I could share with you, you know, because I've had many experiences like that with many people. There were 30, 40 people in that room. And, you know, I sort of think maybe I'm the only one who saw that deal. Seems hard to believe. You're sitting there and you're saying to yourself, well, I would have seen it. Really, you think? You think? There's things that go on in this place. There are people that go on in this place that other people don't even notice, you know, because they're too busy thinking about getting out of the room to send a text message. You don't think that's going on in here? You don't think people are sitting around thinking about what they're going to do when they get out of here, where they're going to eat? They got to get home, you know, they got to turn their cell phone back on. It's a serious disease. Thank you very much. God bless you.